today we're going to be talking about Native American issues and research relating to archival materials. And we actually really have a very outstanding panel today. I'm excited to be able to just be able to sit and listen. So I'm going to do a minimal amount of talking to get you kind of started and also to help them know basically who's in the room so to think about how that they should shape what they're saying for the audience. And up here we have actually first show of hands might be how many people know about the protocols for Native American archives? Cool. Okay. And for those who don't, we're really glad that you're here because that's one of the wonderful things about this is that there's an opportunity to learn more about them. And it is something that all of us are in the process of doing. Of implementing protocols, some in a sort of formal, official way. But many of you who work in archives will be implementing them whether you know it or not and have been using the basic concepts behind it. And just as a little piece, too, in terms of SAA, they were asked to endorse the protocols. It was decided that they were not able to endorse the protocols at that point in time, but there is a working group, and three sessions. We're holding the second session this year, and it will be today, so I encourage you to go to it. It's an outstanding forum of actually implementation of the protocols and the concepts of the protocols, and that will be later today. So it's a really rich program that you've got going on now between our esteemed speakers here and then that presentation later today. Just for those who don't know about them or who haven't, I know when I first read them, it's a pretty deep document. There's a lot of meaning in it, but here we just have sort of the basic concepts that are addressed within it just to give people some kind of context and point of reference to think about it. And let me just look because Jennifer has just texted me. Okay. She says, please make sure to apologize to the session for me. So that's officially done. All right. And then the next thing I'd like to do is show of hands. How many people have Native American materials in their institutions? Okay. How many people work within a college or a university library or archive? Okay. How many people work in a one-person shop? Okay, great. and how many people service tribal individuals within their institution? And you may or may not know that, but that was actually, I should have said how many people know that you do. Let's see, and I already asked about the protocol. So that sort of gives us a concept of who is in there. Oh, I have one more question. I'm sorry. How many people work within tribal institutions? Awesome. Fantastic. Great. So we've got a real mix here, and that's will make it really rich. So in Indian country, if I put it that way, in Indian country, one of the nuances is how people introduce themselves. And so one of the things I've decided to do today, instead of actually introducing our speakers myself, is to allow them to introduce themselves. And actually, before I do that, I should introduce myself because I just started talking instead of doing that. So I'll walk my talk first. Ali Indijnakaz Bawating and Donjaba. My name is Allison Krebs, and I am the chair of the SAA Native American Archives Roundtable. I am also a PhD student, 1 year in at this point, at the University of Washington. Was a Knowledge River Scholar at the University of Arizona, and my passion is what I call indigenous knowledge ecology. And so for that, all of those reasons, I am also a member of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians up in the Great Lakes. And at one point, I ran before I came back to school. I ran our youth education program. So the issues about indigenous knowledge, about our tribal histories, about how we can access for our communities are things that are very near and dear to my heart on both a personal and professional level. And I know that's true for these people, too. So I will allow them to introduce themselves first, and thank you very much.
Kwekwe, hello. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. I'd like to also thank the Algonquins, the tribes whose land we're on here in this area today. My name is Ann Mossman, and I am Algonquin on my father's side, Algonquin First Nation of Pikwakanagon in Ontario. I'm a librarian and archivist from University of New Mexico, though down south, southwest. And I've been interested in and working on Native American archival issues since I was in library school at University of Texas at Austin many years ago in the late 80s, and have worked in terms of preservation and as a university archivist librarian throughout the years based out of this area of New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, Arizona, Colorado, where I've had the privilege to work with many people and get to know many people and issues and tribes of the area. This morning I'm going to be talking about navigating archives for Native American research, focused specifically on research. And I'll be reading from a paper. Gaining access to archival and special collections materials is essential for many forms of research. For Native American research, this access can be vitally important as tribal members and others search for archival resources to aid in research no less critical than land, water, and enrollment claims, as well as cultural preservation and sovereignty initiatives. Archival materials are also of utmost importance to Native American students and scholars who are working to reclaim and provide a Native-driven scholarship that better serves indigenous communities. Native American researchers are thus a diverse and interdisciplinary grouping of Native and non-Native scholars, students, educators, legal teams, research consultants, tribal agency employees, and genealogists, among others, as the potential users of our specialized library and archival materials. Although there have been numerous Native American bibliographies focused on single subjects or single library collections, there is not a research guide that I could find that provides a thorough overview on how to use archives for Native American research in this digital age. The diversity of institutions and the intricate web of access tools make the search for these unique materials difficult for novice researchers and seasoned scholars alike. In July to December of 2009, I began a sabbatical project, or undertook a sabbatical project, that provided the preliminary research for a book intended to assist users in finding archival resources relating to Native American research. This publication that I'm working on, tentatively titled Navigating Archives, a Native American Research Guide, is intended to provide a useful overview of often unfamiliar materials and repositories, as well as addressing some complex issues of Native American archival materials in non-Native institutions. As a special collections librarian and archivist for 20 years now, I've seen researchers of all backgrounds overlook or have difficulty searching the vast resources available to them from the wide variety of libraries, archives, museums, government offices that hold archival and special research materials. I've seen many seasoned scholars as well as the novice researchers miss out on important resources. For today's talk, I'll touch on some of the areas I'll address in my book. Most specifically, the areas I believe we as archivists need to focus on in our work to better connect users with our collections. Certain of these issues are unique to Native Americans, their history, and their status in the U.S. and the Americas. But a good many of the issues, especially those I discuss first, are similar to issues of all archival researchers. First, we need to do more to broaden researchers' knowledge of both archival materials and archival institutions. I'm concerned about researchers who go strictly to familiar resources, such as oral history and photograph collections, not realizing the other forms of records available to them. Likewise, I'm concerned about the lack of knowledge that researchers have about where to find archives. It is a convoluted world of archives out there, with archives that stand alone, such as national, state, and tribal archives, but also archives and manuscript repositories that exist as divisions within libraries, museums, historical societies, cultural centers, religious denominations, and businesses. So there are many archival institutions for researchers to be aware of. Not only that, but these institutions can be geographically quite dispersed, partly because of the nature of governmental, religious, and scholarly interactions, but also because of the vast interest Native peoples have held for North Americans, Europeans, and others around the world. Anthropologists, archaeologists, historians, and tourists are among the many people who have documented indigenous peoples throughout the centuries and brought those records back to their home communities. And many archives and library special collections have been built around a collector's interest in Native Americans, for instance, the High Collection of the National Museum of the American Indian or the Air Collection of the Newberry Library in Chicago. Native American archival materials, like many tribes in the U.S., have made forced or natural migrations to places far from their original homelands and therefore are some of the most vastly dispersed of any research area, I believe. So, in my book, I'm concerned about how to get researchers thinking more broadly about the diverse range of institutions holding archival materials. Word of mouth spreads that there are documents and photographs to be found at the National Archives and the Smithsonian, for instance, and researchers will travel thousands of miles to get here to Washington, D.C., which can prove quite useful to their research. But then they often do not understand that more archival materials are usually available to them back at home. The University of New Mexico Library, the Minnesota Historical Society, the Lawton, Oklahoma Public Library, State Archives of Florida, Nashantucket Pequot Museum. How do we as a profession work to get the word out to tribes and to researchers that we exist? And how do we help researchers to understand how to search for our materials and to know that archives, libraries, and museums often bring different methodologies and technologies to the treatment of their archival holdings? Unfortunately, what this means for researchers is a dizzying array of search tools to contend with. And with some of the many institutions I've talked to about what their how people access their holdings, it runs the gamut from card catalogs and paper finding aids to in-house computer databases to online finding aid projects, online digital collections. It's just an amazing array that still exists out there today. Those archives that spend long, hard hours and untold sums of money perfecting their individual search databases need to remember that the main thing that researchers care about is the topic they are researching, not who has it. For that reason, cross-institutional searching is important to help researchers quickly find who has the needed materials for their research. Telling them that they need to look at dozens of individual search engines is amazingly counterintuitive in this age of Google, and really in any age. Libraries, of course, are the ones who have figured this out long ago and have especially perfected union catalogs in the electronic era. You need to find out what books there are for a particular tribe. Libraries will have online catalogs, often consortial, with multiple libraries in your region. Even better, the highly networked library world has OCLC's WorldCat, now available for free on the web. One huge union catalog to simultaneously search thousands of libraries across the land from the comfort of your home or local library. And archival or manuscript repositories that are part of a library, especially university libraries, will often provide brief descriptions to their archives on WorldCat as well. At the other end of the spectrum, I find, are the museums, where you will often find in-house databases and many old-fashioned card catalogs in cases. They most often allow you to search the collections of one and only one museum at a time. Somewhere in between libraries and museums generally are the archival institutions whose traditions are highly individualistic but have been changing in recent years. Multi-institution access is becoming more common, either via regional consortiums like the Rocky Mountain Online Archive at my institution, which is an EID finding aid site, or via an archive's participation in the Library World's WorldCat, or in OCLC's newer product, Archive Grid. Older forms of access, like NUCMUC, the National Union Catalog of Manuscript Collections, those of you who are my age and older out here, we know about NUCMUC, remember? And the National Inventory of Documentary Sources are still available on Archives Finder, a subscription database. Further, as you can see from these descriptions of the differences between archives, library, and museum methodologies, very often these differences do not hold. Museum archives, for instance, are becoming more common on the consortial finding aids developed by larger archives and libraries. Access to archival materials in any of these institutions may be driven by the methodologies of the parent institution or often by the background and training of the individual archivist in charge. And the issues of archives are further muddied and enriched by the existence of digital collection websites that often provide selections of our collections, which can be confusing if it is not clear that these are only one form of access to the collections, separate from the broader finding aid and catalog search tools. These intricacies may not be new to you as professionals in cultural institutions, but if you look at it through the lens of the diaspora of Native American research materials, you can gain an appreciation for just how difficult and unintuitive we are for our potential researchers. Why do we expect researchers to ferret us out one institution at a time? And why are we surprised when they don't find us? The good news, however, is that we are in a transitional time with cultural institutions beginning to come together to provide less laborious access to potential researchers, I'm finding. Again, many of these access issues are not unique to Native American researchers. Meanwhile, other issues are quite unique because of Native American status. One, as indigenous First Peoples across the North American continent. Two, as sovereign nations with centuries of government-to-government relations with colonial powers and with modern nation states and provinces. Three, as peoples working to repair past wrongs from assimilationist and genocidal policies. Four, as some of the most highly documented peoples on Earth, often perceived as disappearing peoples, that thereby necessitating highly invasive research practices. For these and other reasons, Native American collections and research takes on unique dimensions in the archival world. And so today we talk of cultural sensitivity issues surrounding archival materials relating to Native Americans. There are many efforts afoot through the U.S. and Canada, as well as other locations, in which both researchers and archivists come together to communicate, educate, and to provide one another with archival collections. There are ties to NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection Act, that have resulted in much more openness and respect between tribes and museums across the U.S. The SAA and ALA, the American Library Association, are also preparing statements on cultural property rights relating to traditional cultural expressions, and the First Archivist Circle has developed the protocols for Native American archival materials, which break new ground, but also may simply help archivists to extend the rights and sensitivities long accorded to businesses, governments, and individuals in our archives. When talking of Native American research, we also have to look at the issues of privacy and disclosure that have developed in academic human subjects research policies. Institutional review boards are commonplace for university and government researchers working in communities of all kinds. And now tribes are beginning to form their own institutional review boards, IRBs, too, for researchers wishing to conduct research with tribal members. The National Congress of American Indians now has a policy research center that is working, quote, to assist tribal leaders, Native students, and other Native community members to understand and manage research and program evaluation. The title of this curriculum they're developing is Research That Benefits Native Peoples. Which brings me to my final point about the issues driving and delineating research in Indian country. Following several centuries of Native American research conducted by and for the benefit of non-Native people, there is now an insistence on research to benefit the people and communities being studied. This may be evidenced by the request of tribal members to duplicate our archival materials in order to bring these materials back to their tribes, retroactively benefiting the tribe. And it can also be in the form of more and more archivists working with tribal representatives to determine how to make our research materials useful to the Native communities they originated from. The 2006 Protocols for Native American Archival Materials helps delineate and provide for many of these practices so important under this guiding principle of research benefiting Native people. In summary, current Native American archival research holds both challenges and improvements in better connecting researchers and archival collections. And it certainly is entering a new era as archivists and researchers find ways to move from the old models of primarily documenting Native peoples into the new models with its prerequisites of benefiting Native communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. That was a wonderful overview of the complexity and depth of the issues involved with Native American archival materials, and also the incredible energy that's involved at this point, which I kind of see as almost a paradigm shift from the information flow away and about our communities to the information flow both back and within our communities. So thank you very much, Anne. And we look forward to reading the book, having a copy on our shelves so that we can refer to it constantly. Thank you. And now our next speaker is Diane Bird.
Good morning, everybody. It's good to see everyone, and I see some familiar faces, and I also see a lot of new faces. My name is Diane Bird, and I'm from Santo Domingo Pueblo in New Mexico. I'm a member of the Santo Domingo Pueblo, and I also live at Santo Domingo, and I commute to work at the Laboratory of Anthropology, Museum of Indian Arts and Culture in Santa Fe. So it's kind of like going from home to another home, because there's so many things there. And by that, I mean there's objects in our museum, there's papers in our museum that deal with Santo Domingo or the Pueblos. I can walk to the museum, which is just about 10 steps away from the lab archives, and I can go see pottery, just to see pottery that was made by my great-grandmother. The labels don't show that, or they don't say this is Diane's grandmother, but, you know, it's nice to see that, and then my mom will go with me, and I'll take my daughter, and I say, there's the pottery, and they're big potteries, you know, about as high as a chair or as wide, things like that, or we'll look at kilts or textiles, and we'll read different stories that have been written by Pueblo people or Native people in the Southwest. So that's why I say it's something that when the protocols came about, it was kind of a thing that was very familiar to me and to other staff at the museum, because I think we had been doing it, and we think we are doing it, which was the title of my presentation, was Best Practices, which I tend to call Better Practices, mostly because we haven't documented it. We haven't documented all of it. We haven't written it. We're implementing it daily. It's almost like breathing for a lot of us on staff. But I want to read you a little opening before I get into the talk. And it's about the Pueblo Revolt that I found in a little brochure that I carry around by one of our sister institutions that has a lot of photos, and the researcher actually came and worked in the museum and the archives. It's about the Pueblo Revolt. Any records that might explain what became of Kaua'a, which is a Pueblo close by, were likely destroyed during the Pueblo Revolt of 1680, considered to be the most successful Indian uprising against Europeans within the current boundaries of the United States. The revolt culminated after 100 years of strained relations between the Pueblo Indians and Spanish interlopers. Policies of forced labor, tribute, and education of Indian children in missions, the banning of ceremonial rituals, feuding between Spanish governors and clergy, disease, and a major drought contributed to a buildup of resentment toward the colonists. In August 1680, most Indian pueblos in New Mexico joined together, attacking missions, ranches, and government offices, killing priests and settlers, and burning or destroying property. Spanish citizens, joined by people of Isleta and other villages nearby, fled south to El Paso del Norte, which is near Juarez, and remained for 12 years before returning to northern New Mexico. This is kind of like, in a nutshell, the background of where I come from and what we've lived through and what we remember. And it also reflects kind of the tension, which I think is positive and leads to more positive connections in working with Native tribes in New Mexico. That it's not something that came about with NAGPRA. It's not something that came about with archaeologists. For us in New Mexico, it goes back a long, long time. The Laboratory of Anthropology, in conjunction with the School of American Research, was established in 1927, and the doors of the lab were opened in 1931. The lab was meant to serve as a home and office for anthropologists and archaeologists conducting field research in the Southwest, not just New Mexico. The archives itself was established in 1989. The Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, a separate building, was opened in 1985 to serve as an exhibit space for collections housed at the lab. They had formerly been used in what is now the library of the Laboratory of Anthropology. The lab serves as a state repository for all materials excavated on public land in New Mexico. The Archaeological Research Materials Section, known as ARMS, maintains paper records such as maps, field notes, photos, and the Archaeological Research Collections curates objects. An off-site repository for ARC will open this fall. The various staff at the lab, curators, archaeologists, the librarian, archivists, and administrators, have developed and maintained connections with local tribal communities in the Southwest, especially New Mexico. There are 19 pueblos, now 20 in New Mexico and Texas. The Hopi, Navajo, and Apache nations are involved in one way or another with the museum and lab. Community members share ideas, staff and community members share ideas on implementation of policies and procedures. This is almost a daily, if not weekly, continuous part of working at the museum. The museum established an Indian Advisory Panel in 1984. All staff work with the panel throughout the year. The panel is composed of about 16 members, and we could have up until about 26, representing Southwest tribes, and meets at least three times a year. The IAP has bylaws and elects a chair and vice chairperson. I serve as coordinator of the IAP. The IAP is informed and participates in or knows of exhibits, conservation projects, public programs, and education programs. Regular consultation with both the IAP and individual tribes takes place regularly, not just at the meetings. NAGPRA is considered separate, so the IAP is informed of it, and some of the IAP may have dual membership, both on the IAP and serving from respective tribes as NAGPRA representatives or consultants. This best practice has been developed through mutual respect and collaboration between many people and professions since the day the lab opened. We are now attempting to document this procedure so that it is intertwined in policies such as the collections policies and the culturally sensitive policies of the Museum of New Mexico, and in the Cultural Properties Act, New Mexico State Annotated 1978, Section 181611-1, that authorizes confidentiality of site locations. As a Native archivist, I work with many other Native individuals as well as museum staffs. I usually get phone calls every day, not just from researchers, but other people. They can be Native staff, they can be other museum staff, and they say, Diane, what do you think about this photo? What do you think about this text? What do you think about this, that, and the other? If I can answer it, I answer it. If I can't, I'll refer them to other people. I also serve on the New Mexico Historical Records Advisory Board with the State Archives and the New Mexico Humanities Council. So this kind of keeps me busy with a lot of researchers and processing of records at the lab, fielding calls, just doing a lot of things. And I think we're all that way at the lab. It's a fun place to work. I enjoy it. And I think there's room for improvement, and we'll see how it goes from there. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Diane. I want to say we have incredible expertise sitting up here. And lived and deeply committed experience to their communities and to the communities that they serve, much as we do, I'm sure, out in the audience here. Given that we had that thunderstorm this morning, and our third speaker is still on her way to us, and for those of you who entered the room after we began, she has already sent her apologies for not being here yet, and I'm sure at some point she's going to come running in the back going, I am so sorry. But I think it's like many things. Well, first of all, when that happened this morning, I thought, wow, we must be about to say something really important because the sky just opened big time. The thunders, I mean, in my area, we talk about the thunders coming in, and they really came in this morning. So I'm humbled by that. And I think that the opportunity that that they have given us is that instead of having us, you know, talk continually to you, having heard these two pieces of concerns, of deep experience, commitment, and as Diane said, better practices, I think that we have the opportunity now to begin to have some questions come from the audience. And oh, good, we got one right away. So okay, yeah. The first thing I got to tell you is that we're supposed to repeat questions, so I'm going to try to bundle that up. No, just because they're taping. So, and so the first thing that I'd like to say before I repeat your question is we are so glad that you are here. I mean, it makes us really happy. To then think about the questions that you ask, or to restate them, as I understood them at least, and each of our speakers will have their own interpretation of it. But one of the primary questions was terminology and the implications for terminology, both sort of more, I don't know if you use the word offensive, but I would, you know, I would maybe twist it into that. And then in terms of the ways that materials have been described and the issues around that. And so then I'd take it over to whoever wants to respond to that. You can both respond too.
Let's see, can you hear me or should I? Is it on? Okay, I think it's on. In terms of talking about or looking at terms, derogatory, other terms that we wouldn't use today or that we're concerned about, how Indigenous people feel about certain terms, I like to put things into this context for archives. I use food analogies a lot when I'm working with student groups and all and explaining to them the differences between secondary sources, the books, the published material, museum curated exhibits, for instance, are like secondary sources books published. They're put together by somebody with their expertise, their point of view, and put out there. And in the food world, I think of that as the restaurants, right? You have somebody who's made decisions about how to present, how to, you know, what you're going to eat. Archives, though, we're like the grocery stores of the food world, and we put it out there for other people to make their decisions of what they're going to make of these ingredients. And some of those ingredients are not so pretty when it comes to like what you're talking about, materials that can be considered really offensive. And we don't look to cleanse or change those or hide those or destroy those necessarily. so that they're there for people. So if somebody is looking at racism or looking at policies, detrimental policies for their tribe or things like that, they're going to have those raw materials there to work with to show what really happened. But in terms of terminology for description, so you're doing a finding aid for a collection, that is the point where you might, or you're doing something digital online, that might be the point where you, where libraries or archives might change some of the terms. So instead of saying squaw or, you know, something like that, they would, you know, say woman, or they would try to find the name of a person, you know, and not, because that's one of the big issues, too, is that, you know, unidentified Native people in photographs. These people have names. These people have, you know, all kinds of identifying information. So I don't know if that helps a little bit to think about on one side, we don't look to change how things were referred to in the past, but for descriptive purposes we might. And then, boy, that could be a whole long description about what terms, you know, Native American, American Indian, Indigenous, Aboriginal, things like that. I mean, that's a whole long discussion, but you know that Library of Congress still subject heading still is Indians of North America is still the long moniker, and then also subject headings, you take a tribe's name and you put the word Indians after it. So for instance, Santo Domingo Pueblo is Santo Domingo Indians, and things like that as ways to search. So sometimes we're still constrained if we're part of a library and using those terms. So that's what I would how I would address that question.
One of the best things, I think, is by you asking questions like that and having researchers ask questions like that, so and discussing it openly. Because, say, like in New Mexico, there are people, like in Native people, that we refer to ourselves. We won't refer to ourselves as First Nations. That's just now coming into style. It's something that we've always known, and if we're talking in our own languages, like we have our own governments, I have a government that I have that I fall under, and then there's also a larger one called the All Indian Public Council, and in those councils they're known by their own names. Like we don't go by the Spanish names. Like the Spanish name for my pueblo is Santo Domingo, and that actually means Saint Dominic, which is the patron saint, the Catholics that came in. But all the pueblos, most of the pueblos in New Mexico, I'd say out of the 18 in New Mexico, carry maybe about 14 or 15 of them carry Spanish names. And so there's, when we talk to each other, we'll say Indian or we'll say Native. If I'm writing for a larger group, I'll use Indigenous communities. And a lot of times that's even to delineate even further that if you see the term Pueblo, because there are Spanish villages that are still known as Pueblos, that's a Spanish name. And that's to kind of distinguish between Spanish and Indigenous people in New Mexico. Because a lot of the Spanish people, not a lot, a few of them in New Mexico have land grants from the time that they came in. So they will sometimes describe themselves as Indigenous people of the Southwest. So we do have names, and usually when we're talking to each other or amongst each other, we kind of know who we are. As an archivist, the only names that I've run across that are negative are the usage of sometimes geographical names like Squaw Peak. In a photograph, they may say Navajo Squaw or Apache Squaw, and it's changing that to the name of, like, this is an Indian woman. This is an Indian man. It's not a buck. You know, he's not a buck, that kind of thing. It's changing that. A lot of it, too, which I don't like, is when they do name somebody, they spell out the Indian name phonetically, and they put hyphens in. And I've tried taking out the hyphens, and because it's a more realistic name, especially if they're using it. And when I really have question marks, I'll go to Indian people. I mean, I can pick up the phone. I can call somebody in Hopi or someplace in Taos, and I'll say, Vernon, tell me what the name of the lake is up there that you have by Taos. And then he'll call me back in a little bit, or I can leave a message, or we'll just talk right that day. And I'll give him the context of what's going on. These could, it depends on what it is. I mean, if it's an international researcher, we've had people from Japan come in that want to know how we deal with unaffiliated people that are tribal people because they want to start something in Japan. And, you know, we go over the whole realm with them. And it's not just one person. It's more than one person working with that researcher. And we just take it as part of our jobs.
I also have one little thing to add to that is that up at University of Washington in one of our classes this year, one of my co-PhD students and I produced a little short video, which may be on YouTube. You might be able to find it there, but it's called What's in a Name? And it takes a look at sort of those cataloging issues in terms of American Indian, Native American. We're really lucky up there that we have three of us as graduate students who are working together, one who's Yaqui and one who's Zuni and Tlingit, and then I'm Anishinaabe. So there's like an ability to begin to discuss some of those issues and take a look at, okay, how do we easily explain this? And that's how we came up with this little video. So if you look at just another little piece in Library of Congress subject headings, I'm from a tribe from Michigan, and if you look at Indians, North America, Michigan, it has Sac and Fox, it has the Potawatomi, no, it has Odawa, and but there are 13 tribes in Michigan. It has does not mention Ojibwe, Chippewa, Anishinaabe. I mean, so any of the words that you would want to search on, and then plus we have 13 tribes. Three are Odawa, but they're Odawa and Ottawa, and you know, so it's different spelling. That how you begin to find materials, and I'm sure that nuance once you get into archival materials is even more difficult. So, like many things, I think in this whole area of discussion, both within the protocols, there's a favorite word I've come up with, which I think is from mathematics, which is complexification. And I will tell you that if you want a simple answer, you're in the wrong area.
And I would say, too, a lot of times I tell researchers, I say, boy, you know, think about all the different particular names and terms. You know, don't just choose one, and don't just choose, like, Hopi to search. You know, think of Moki, think of this, and, you know, try different terms because of that.
Yeah, and then spellings, too. I mean, spellings is a whole another matter. So, let's have show of hands on questions again. Okay, we're going to go. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, and 4, if you remember your numbers. I think you were 1.
I know a number of tribal governments are establishing their own archives now. Are those archives generally open to all researchers or just tribal members?
Okay, now I happen to know that we have some experts sitting in the audience who might be able to address that question if they want to. I'm not putting anybody on the spot, but and if not, we can address it generically from up here. But yes, Elaine. Thank you very much, Elaine. I'll try to do justice to your answer, just so that I know it's a little bit harder. And I wish we had a moving mic, but I'm really honored that of the quality of all of you in our audience, and I know that you each have something to contribute, and I hope that you take the opportunity to do so. Elaine was saying that in her archive. That there's when researchers come in who are non-tribal researchers, correct? That they need to go through tribal council in order to get approval to research what they're interested in, and then if they are approved, that they also give a presentation back to the community. And I think what's really interesting is this begins to show the actual activation, the life of the protocols as they are actually being experienced, and I'm sure a number of you in institutions have those stories too, which we would love to be hearing, because I think that that's, again, it's something that as a community of people who are taking care of tribal records, we have a responsibility and you all are living that in different ways. So it's wonderful to hear in what ways. I don't know if I left the presentation to the community. And then was the last part about publication? I couldn't hear exactly what the last... Yeah, so in terms of publication then, that there will be a draft that's sent to the council to review and approve, and if is approved, then it can go to publication, and also then that copies of the publication will come to the archive, and they actually have a beautiful triumvirate of archive, library, and museum now, which is, I haven't seen the library. Is it done now? Yes, so, it's just that we have another wonderful example of the dynamism within and innovation within Indian Country in the room. Thank you so much for sharing that. Would speakers like to address that?
I think some of the tribal archives that are, she's here, welcome. Some of the tribal archives that have been established are open basically for community members, and outside researchers will follow a procedure that has been established by the tribe or the archives as to how to access those materials. Some of the tribal archives also are located in public libraries, tribal public libraries, so that information is available, the librarian or the archivist in that tribal institution will say which parts are just public, and there isn't any problem there. But I will say that there are some tribes that do have their archives which are basically closed to outsiders. So, but I wouldn't be able to tell you right now which ones are and aren't, or which collections are or aren't.
Okay, well, Jennifer has arrived. Yeah, and we're so glad that she's made it. I'll tell you what a storm that was this morning. No, we understand it. We're happy that you're here. So if you'd like to come up and get settled and, just jump right in. We actually, it was a wonderful opportunity, though, Jennifer. Don't feel bad, because we were able to open it up and begin to have some of the expertise in the room manifest itself, too. So should I put you right in the hot seat?
Sure. So sorry.
Oh, no.
I don't do have them.
Okay. And actually, while I'm setting it up, I know we got to question one. We had two, three, and four. Does somebody else want to ask a question while I'm getting this set up?
Yes, you in the back.
I'm just curious.
Okay. The question is that, say, Santo Domingo Pueblo, for instance, in particular, there's archival material located in the Spanish archives in Spain?
I wonder if there are ways of Spanish.
Well, I think there's records that have been copied from the Spanish archives. I don't know how many. I've had contact with some researchers from Spain or Mexico that are looking for records, and oftentimes those records are located in the state archives. And the other place that the records are available, that tribes have done research or hired people to do research, is because of ongoing legal land or water rights disputes. So I know those records exist. I know where some of the copies are, but some of those records are not accessible to researchers until this case is settled. And the case is like about 35 years old. I've talked with the lead attorneys because I processed one of the collections. And I've talked to one of the lead attorneys, and since the case is so old, he's wanting to make some of the earlier expert reports available that did use archival material, because he's saying that in the 30 years since, it would be wise to make it available to researchers of today, because there have been so many new ideas and concepts that have come about and that have been implemented that he wants these certain records made available. But we're still working on that, amongst other things.
And as Diane said, the State Archives has a good amount of material documenting the early Spanish and Mexican periods of our what's today our state. University of New Mexico, my library, we're really extensively into Spanish colonial materials, and there's been a whole cadre of researchers over the years, Franz Scholes, John Kessel, Eleanor Adams, who have worked to bring back documents from the Spanish archives in Sevilla, Spain, the Archivos de los de las Indias, and then in Mexico City, the Archivos de la Nación, so AGI, AGN, and we have those materials. So one of the things with what I talked about with research materials available and getting the word out is university libraries and others often have extensive documentation pulled from places like that, documenting all these time periods that can help, in addition to the work, as Diane said, that legal teams have, what they've gathered.
First of all, again, I just apologize for being so late. It's like Murphy's Law, you know, the one time you're presenting or doing anything, my entire street was flooded and the metro was closed because of power outages. So I really apologize. I'm so sorry. I'm just excited I finally made it. Oh, so I apologize again. But I'm so excited to be here and to see so many people here and familiar faces. So I appreciate you all for being here. And because I am running late, I'm just going to kind of breeze through the presentation and go over some of the basics at our repository, and then a touch on some of the cultural stewardship that we do at the Archive Center. And so we have plenty of time for questions, because I know that's what's most important. And I apologize if some of you already are very familiar with our Archive Center, but for those of you that aren't, that's why I want to cover just some basics. But first of all, for those of you who don't know me, I'm Jennifer O'Neill. I'm the head archivist at the National Museum of the American Indian. I'm also a member of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde in Oregon. And I served on the group that drafted the protocols for Native American archives, and also currently serve on the steering committee for the Native American Archive Roundtable, and then also just got appointed to the Cultural Property Working Group. So you'll probably see me in various groups or things of that nature, but that's just a little bit of my background. Can you go back one? Sorry, I'll let you go back one. Do you need this?
Yeah.
Sorry, getting ahead of myself. Basically, I just wanted to cover. Great, see, it's happening already. Bear with us. But I just wanted to share a few pictures to show some background on the history of the museum that aren't familiar with it, and because the history of the museum and how it was formed directly correlates to the collections that we have. So here we have a picture of the Museum of the American Indian on 155th and Broadway in New York City, which was the original museum in New York City, whose collection we then inherited in 1989 when the museum became part of the Smithsonian. So it was a gorgeous building, and that museum existed from 1916 to 1989. And was officially established by George Gustav High, and his life dates are here, 1874 to 1957, and he was directly responsible for a significant amount of collecting from the late 1800s until his eventual death. So that's the bulk of the collection, although they were still collecting later. And here we have pictures of actual George High. He's in the middle there with his wife, Thea High, and then one of the anthropologists and collectors, Harmon Hendricks. and then a view of the display cases on the third floor in that same building. It's just interesting to kind of see, you know, how items used to be displayed and just kind of the storage there. And then actually in our archives, we have one of the old card catalogs that they had used for the actual cards for each item. So, and then of course when the Smithsonian overtook that collection and created NMAI, we have the three locations. This is the first location that was created in New York, the George Gustav High Center, which functions as both an exhibit space and public programs, but none of our collections are stored there. All collections are stored at the Cultural Resource Center out in Suitland, Maryland, which is also where the Archive Center is located. And here we also have our conservation department, all the collections, archives, IT, and where we really feel is the heart of the museum, because this space is also used for community members and for people to come and see the collection and really have those one-on-one consultations with community members. And then, of course, we have the main museum downtown, which is also an exhibit, public program space, rotating exhibits. Now I just wanted to go into an overview of the museum collections. We have over 800,000 object items and growing to this day, and continues to grow and cover the entire Western Hemisphere, as well as Hawaii, for everywhere from, you know, Alaska all the way to the tip of Chile. So we have a very extensive collection, particularly within the object collection. Within the museum, the Archive Center is part of the museum, and we are considered part of the official museum's collection, although we kind of function outside of course, the object collection. And within the Archive Center, we have three major parts of it: manuscripts, photos, and also media archives. So those are our three major areas that we call the actual types and the largest collections. We also have about four full-time employees, and we are always having usually two to three interns at one time to help us with processing and cataloging, things like that. So, and just a little bit background on media archives, just give you an indication, we have a vast array from all different types of formats, from motion picture to analog to wax cylinders. And then we also have a study collection of the Film and Video Center, which that's located up in New York at the GGHC. But we have a study collection of that as well on site for people to view those items. We really feel that the photo archives is a lot the heart of the collection, because it is so large, and because it really documents the work that the museum did in the early days of their collecting in the 1900s, and documents many of the expeditions, as well as just the types of collections that the museum was interested in, and just some wonderful photographs, both Edward Curtis and then just also the photographs that were taken by the expeditions. But then we also have collections that really reflect also just Native American history and the events that happened in the United States that affected, particularly with like the boarding schools, which I like to show this photograph just to show the harsh effects of the boarding schools, because here you can see the children dressed in their native clothing with their long hair, and you know, the way their heritage really shows them. But then you see a photo of them just the next year, and then just the stellar change in their appearance and in how it changed them culturally. We get a lot of questions about, well, okay, what do you have? But we also want to say what we don't have. We don't have genealogical records, and we also don't have official government records, meaning like BIA records and congressional records. We do have like papers like the National Congress of the American Indian and political papers, that sort of thing, but we do not have these sorts of records. We then direct people to the National Archives, and so we are definitely a partner with them in trying to direct people in the right direction. We understand it's a very complex area with all these different agencies and different places to do this research, so we work in conjunction with a lot of the different Smithsonian archives and different repositories like National Anthropological Archives, because it's very confusing. And one example of that is, I don't know if Anne talked about it, but we had the Tribal Heritage Fellows come from an IMLS program in June to visit all the different repositories in Washington, D.C. during a week for research that they were doing to take back to their community. So it was actual tribal members. And we did a day-long presentation of all different repositories in D.C. that they were going to visit and give them an overview, and you could just tell it's very overwhelming and just trying to understand the differences and where different things are located. So we try to, as best we can, try to explain to them why it's kind of so complicated and where things are at and direct them to the right locations. And once they kind of understand that, they're very excited to go and do their research, but it's actually just trying to direct them in the right location. Some of our great online resources is we are part of and put our data into the Smithsonian Institution Research Information System, or also known as CIRIS. So all of our online records, digitized records, can be found in that system, as well as NMAI's Collections Online Search, which is an initiative that has been in force in some time, but just launched last year, which both has photos online of our ethnographic historical images, but also of actual objects that are in the object collection. So it's a great resource for tribal members who cannot come to the museum, but that way they can see the objects that relate to their cultures. Because we, at this point, only have, you know, like 2% of our collection up. But what we try to do is put up images from each culture so people know who are coming online there can see at least a couple images from their region or from their tribe or something of that nature. I don't really have time to go into too much of this, so I'm kind of breeze over this because I don't want to spend too much time. But usually with this sort of presentation, I also give a background about the protocols on Native American archive materials, because the Archive Center adopts many of the issues in the protocols. However, I just want to point out as well that NMAI, even before the protocols were drafted, already followed many of the guidelines within the protocols already. So I feel that NMAI was far ahead of its time in working on many of these issues. So even though we've gone far and above the protocols, we also try to adopt everything that is in the protocols because we feel they are so important. And this slide is just to give you some background information on the protocols that for those of you who aren't familiar with them. And basically to explain to you kind of the background and how it was developed and began in 2006, and that our model document was the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander protocols, and that it was a long process, and it was finally actually completed in April 2007, and it's online through the First Archivist Circle website and can be downloaded and printed out as a PDF. And this is a list of the main concepts that were behind it. And the main ideas behind the protocols was actually building collaboration and stewardship and creating respect and reciprocity with the tribes or any culture you were working with, although it's very specific to Native American archives and that culture. Many of these concepts, I feel, can be applied or applicable to any culture you may be working with to respect their wishes and their needs and to serve them as best as possible. And I just wanted to point out that, you know, these two ideas, that it embraces alternative approaches to archival ethics, and it's important in transformational work. It's not easy, but it's important to at least try and to see what kind of strides you can make to work with your community members. And this is also just an overview that although they weren't endorsed by SAA in the time that it was brought before them, SAA Council did decide to create these forums, which the second one is being held this afternoon at 12:15, where we do give case studies, and it's a chance for the SAA membership to actually speak about the protocols and to discuss issues that they have. So please, if you're interested, I really highly suggest you coming to the forum this afternoon. There's going to be a presentation by Dr. Kim Christian from Washington State University about the Plateau People's Web Portal, which is a fantastic case study for the protocols in action, working with the Plateau tribal members in that region. So please come if you have a chance, and you can also ask further questions that you may not have a chance to ask here. And then also, as I mentioned before, there's SAA created the Cultural Property Working Group just this past year. And I just, as I'm going forward, I just wanted to mention a few actions of how the NMAI incorporates the protocols and tries to really harness stewardship and cultural collaboration with tribal members. Here, this is just kind of an overview, again, going into indigenous cultural property. I don't want to spend too much time on this. I want to get more into the cultural stewardship at NMAI archives and touch on a few of these items, showing how we work with the communities and also how when individuals want to come do research, how we work with them. The first thing that we provide is spaces for them to conduct ceremonies because we feel that's an important thing for many of the tribal members who are coming. Even if you're not a tribal member, if you feel that it's important for you to do some sort of ceremony, we provide a space both indoors and outdoors where people can, it's okay if we have burning permits inside the building where people can do smudgings or any type of ceremony that they feel is necessary before they handle object items or before they even look at the archives or photos, or if they want to do it afterwards as well. For example, with our interns this summer, we had one from the Navajo Nation, and you know, it was just she felt it was important for her to do some sort of event and ceremony after she was leaving because of this type of things that she had seen and worked with, and just to make sure she was cleansed before she left. So we provide that, which is very unique for any type of archive, I think, but we want to provide that for our patrons. And the largest thing that we try to do is do collaborative curation. And what I mean by this is that, particularly with our photos that we have, when any tribal members come to do research or any community members that come to look at object items in the object collection, we try to ensure that they always stop by the photo archives or even just to look at some manuscripts, because if we have anything that they could help describe or that they could recognize individuals in the photos, and it's more times than not that when they do come in, they do recognize people that they know, or they can describe cultures that we haven't yet listed in our catalog, and so it helps us tremendously. So it's not only helping them because they get to see photos where they see their culture represented, but then they are also assisting us. So it's reciprocity in action. And we also try to assist them in any way possible in giving copies of photos that they're interested in, sending them reports, making sure that that's shared with them. And also, one other example of that is shared resources. We have films from expeditions that were done and working with different communities throughout the United States and from the early 1900s. And what we've done is tried to make copies of those, and we share those with the different communities. And it's been very popular because many of them don't have copies or some of those cultural traditions are being lost. So they're showing those films in their cultural centers, and it's become very popular, particularly with the Zuni, who we've given them copies of these films, and it's one of the most popular things that they have in their cultural center. And we've had to send them extra copies because the DVD is, like, you know, run out. So it's very exciting for us to be able to do that. And then we also, with the collaborative curation, have really recognized the importance of the knowledge keepers, meaning the tribal members who come in, who particularly the elders, who know so much and can have that opportunity to share information with us. Anyway, I hope this information is helpful and that it can be of use to you to know how, at least at the NMAI Archive Center, how we really try to involve researchers and any community members or tribal members that come in to either conduct research or just coming in to see what we have. And we just try to make them a part of the process and not putting them at arm's length, but really involving them in the entire process. So here's my information, and feel free to contact me at any time with any questions or if you want to discuss this any further or find out any additional information about the Archive Center and what we have, because I'd be happy to discuss this at any time with you. And we're open it up to questions, again, if you have specific questions for me or for the entire panel. So questions? Oh, sure.
Yeah, so questions, and we had some that didn't get answered to begin with, and if they want to go now, or if there are new questions, which could very well happen. Yes.
I know that we would like to do that, but we'd like to try to do it in partnership with the Tribal Archives, Libraries, and Museums workshop, not this coming year, but the year after. So we're going to try to do a session workshop then. So it won't be this year, but it would be the following year. And we're also, if you were at the roundtable, I also announced that we're trying to partner with Oregon State University, who's trying to do training for their federally recognized tribes, which are 9 in the state of Oregon. So that's more a locally based training, but on a national level, we're trying to do it with the IMLS folks. So, and as soon as we have any information about that, we will definitely post it to the roundtable listserv as well as the website. So just stay tuned.
Would either of the other of you like to address that question? I was just thinking. Okay, I'm gonna lead you. Oh, you're gonna go to it.
We were talking the other day, and one of the things I suggested was that SAA conduct workshops like they do the other workshops, you know, encoded archival description, like that, is that we have one sponsored or have a couple sponsored by SAA as part of the education programs. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think that it's an excellent question, and I think it brings up one of the things I've been hearing in all of this is that, and I happen to know from each one of these individuals that there is tremendous opportunity for collaboration, and that's a very rich possibility to have happen. And so I think that's something that keep asking that question. Because it would be nice to be able to have things happen locally. I think one of the real opportunities today is that you all have now know 3 incredible resources, and the connections that these 3 resources have, the potential they have to bring you help, to answer questions, to connect you up with people when they don't know the answer, and to model you know, the way that you can engage and bring these practices to life is sitting here. So I'm really glad you asked that question, and please, I encourage you all to ask it in as many environments as possible. State libraries are a possibility. We just we announced in the roundtable yesterday that we've just gave a letter of support for a project. I know I'm not going to say the state right.
Oregon.
anyway, I would have said Oregon. I know, that's why I looked at her. I know. Oh. But so there are opportunities, you know, with what's happening in Oklahoma, what's happening. There are different opportunities, and I think the more that we look at combined interests, resources. I know that we have at least one university librarian here, head of university libraries here. So, you know, there are a number of ways that we can make those things happen. Okay, another question.
Well, particularly at NMAI, we are very, very specific on our detailing of photographs. We go into very detail on our item cataloging for each photograph and do extensive research. And within it, if you go on our collection search or the CIRIS site, we not only give the catalog number and all that information, but we also give our own detailed description of not only the background of the photographer, but also a description of what the individual is wearing. And we also distinguishing this was most likely a staged photograph. And we also, because we do get that question quite often, I was actually just dealing with someone. It was our NMAI archive intern. She wrote on our CIRIS blog because we wanted to have our interns actually show some work they were interested in or talk about the work they were doing. And so she highlighted some some Navajo images that she selected, and she was great, and she knew that as well. She pointed out, and in her entry will be up shortly on the Cirrus blog if you're interested in seeing it, but she pointed out there was a, it was one at Chaco Canyon where the photographer who and the expedition there, they were all staged photographs. She could tell they were all staged. And so it was great having her perspective and her explaining that as well, because we knew that, but it was great to also have just verification from an actual tribal member regarding that. So in all instances, we try to give the researcher as much information as possible, because we don't want them to be swayed in thinking this is like authentic, or the Native American person would just be standing there against a wall, and you know, so we try to do that as much as possible. And I don't know if Diane and Anne want to comment as well.
We get a lot of I get a lot of inquiries, and sometimes other staff do at the lab, mostly because there's a lot of really great photos of people in the Southwest, and I think that kind of accompanies the feathered hair, head bonnets, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then people will send in a photo because it's something that they've had in their family, or somebody's purchased, or it's been hanging on the dining room wall for a long time, and they'll send a photo and they want it identified. So we'll look at it. And one of them that was really perplexing was of a woman, but she was wearing like a buckskin dress, a Navajo jewelry, like a belt. And then she, underneath that, she had a Pueblo belt, and then there was a Pueblo pot in the picture. And they were really wanting to know what Indian tribe she belonged to. And it was, I think, identified as Apache. And she wasn't Apache. She was a Pueblo Indian. There was a photographer that used her in various photos, in various costumes, and sold these photos all over the country. And we had to tell the person the truth. You know, this you've got a nice photo, but, you know, that kind of thing. And but it's information like that that's really important, and it puts it in perspective. Photos are a whole nother workshop. Yeah. That's a whole another workshop.
Yeah. Yes.
I realize, looking back on 10 plus years of working with them, that I fielded all sorts of reference questions when I worked in the language program and in our Department of Natural Resources. But I didn't know that that's what they were. You know, what's this in the language? What's that? What, you know? And also the tribal archivist who might also be the librarian, museum curator, and all, you know, all the hats. You can talk about those.
Okay. Do you want to? Who wants to take that one? All those hats. Okay, rephrase it. So there were. I guess there are two parts to that. One is that when you work within a tribe, you end up being a reference source for many, many kinds of questions. And I hope I'm not reading between the lines in that, but that's even those questions can often be difficult even to answer if you're working in the tribe, you're a tribal member, that, you know, it's not all surficial information, and so you have to work at that. Is that the first part? And then the second part, I think, is addressing, if you could address the many hats that may have to be worn, and this may also then go out to in the audience, if there's anybody who wants to address that, either those who already have a lot of hats on for their own tribe, or who are trying to set up something where they know that they're going to have a whole hat rack with a whole bunch of them on there, you know? And or headdress, and it might be a different kind than what you're used to. So does anybody up here want to address those questions first?
I at least know that, I'm not the archivist for my tribe. I mean, I'm here at the Archive Center, but I know and I work with our cultural resource manager, and because we are trying to establish our tribal archives, actual records management, because what we have is cultural resources, and within that we have it like tribal education, and also we also have a small actual object collection. And so what's been difficult for us is actually we've been lucky enough to be able to expand that portion of it, but now we are having to work on the actual records management side of it because the tribe wasn't sure where to actually put that aspect. So right now it resides with the tribal council, with our tribal secretary, and kind of overseeing that. So, you know, it like many of you know, this it's different for each tribe, each tribal cultural resource center. There is no one right answer, or it's not going to be the same almost anywhere, because it also is depending on how much backing and support and funds you get from your tribal council on the initiatives that they want to take on that certain year, and it changes from each tribal council that comes in and out. At least I know from our experience that's what's been happening. They're really supportive of the education, but they're not, and of cultural heritage, but it's hard for them to see, to put putting funds into and support for like records management, because it's so not tangible right at the moment, you know, it's more. So that's at least my perspective. And I know even within the Archive Center, I wear numerous hats for all the work that I have to do, which is also very, very challenging, because I'm not only trying to manage the entire department, but I'm also trying to raise funds all the time. Even though we are a federal repository, we still have to raise funds. So we spend a ton of time doing that, just trying to figure out where, if we lose staff, where are we going to get more funds, and trying to do the processing, and then also just the administration, and just it's enormous. So. But I think that's the case for any person in this room who is trying to manage their archive or library or museum. So I hope that addressed your question, and if Diane or Anne wants to add anything.
The one thing I'd add is that a lot of times, like I'll say again, because we're in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and because of the expertise, not just that is in the archives, but within staff, we get a lot of questions. And sometimes I can answer that question very quickly and easily. Other times, I'll have to call one of the Indian Advisory Panel members or a community member if it's really a specific type of research question and that we're not handling it there at the lab, then there's people. And that's one of the things that I like to do, that we like to do at the lab, is that if people are conducting research, it's not this thing of Indians living in the past or using the past tense. You know, Indians were, Indians farmed, Indians hunted, that kind of thing. Especially, you know, some people are doing things like that, but we'll connect them with a tribal member or tribal members to say, ask the people that are living here in the Pueblos. And a lot of researchers are surprised that they can do that. Mm-hmm. They'll look at me and say, I can do that? And I say, yeah, here's the number, you know, just call this person. I'll call them for them and say, so-and-so Ann wants to talk with you about whatever, lithic points or textiles, Pueblo textiles. And a lot of times, Pueblo members with specific skills and expertise are very, very willing to share that, and especially to talk with the researcher to find out what they're doing, what's going on in their world. And it's a give and take on both sides. It's a two-way street. Other researchers don't want to talk to community members. I mean, they think it's everybody's past. So working with those types of researchers is a lot more difficult, and we get into some things about that. All of us wear many hats. I know when I was at NMAI as a head archivist within the institution there, it was like working with SI archivist committee. It was working on the repatriation committee. It was working with the unit staff thing, and it was working with conservation. People from conservation or interns would be running over bringing me tablitas from the Southwest and saying, how do we restore this? And I'm telling them, you don't. In the Pueblo world, that was meant, it was created, it has a life, it has a birth, it has a life, and then it dies. So don't touch it. And they were like, we can't touch it? I said, well, don't restore it, you know, that kind of thing. And so it just goes, it's very much a live place to work.
Yes.
So, yeah, we just do it. Don't ask us how.
And there's the takeaway. Just do it. So I hate to say it. This is a conversation I would love to have go on for ages and ages and ages. And I hope that we have more opportunities to get together to do it. But it is now 10:02, so we're past our time. I want to thank all of you for being here, and I'd really like to thank our presenters. And I hope that the biggest takeaway is that, you know, you have resources now that you didn't have before on so many levels, and I encourage you to access them. And thank you. Cool.